Okay, in lesson 13, the questions, question 2 and 3, I said write a paragraph. You may not have chosen to write a paragraph. Really what I'd like to just talk about a little bit is, by way of review, is we've been talking about Congregationalists and that whole line, and the question is, how did they get started? Talking about how the Congregationalists, what was the whole business, what was the whole purpose of, what was the reason for even coming into existence?
Separation.
Autonomy was one answer.
Separation of church and state.
Well, separation from something in particular, in one case, and it is separation of church and state, indirectly. Where did they come out? What group did they come out of? Church of England. And so they were trying to do something with respect to the Church of England, at least their predecessors, and that is to, not unlike, kind of sort of parallel to, Luther and what he was trying to do with the Catholic Church, the groups that dealt with the, were in the, originally in the, people were originally in the Church of England, they wanted to purify the Church of England. They wanted to reform it from within. And that it was pretty drastic, one aspect of it, because it called for the dismantling of the power structure, in essence. They wanted, as was said, separate the church from the state, the control of the state. And so, as a result of that, several groups would break off, and then other things would come about downstream of that. Can you all stand in the fan? Okay, for those of you who are warm back there, you can come sit up here. Okay. What were the beginning doctrines of the congregational churches? Just the basic doctrines they held. Well, I can see that got through real clearly. Okay, well, okay, that's true. I mean, they did hold to that. Some hold to three. Okay, what do we call? What do we? I mean, were they free will people? Were they once saved, you'll be lost someday? What'd you say? Calvinists. Their doctrine was theology when they started out was Calvinist, Calvinistic. It would modify itself. They had organization.
I was going to say they ruled themselves. That's why they call them congregation.
Yeah, organizationally there was something else.
It
goes back to separate from the state, that is the king, in the case of King, Church of England, was the ultimate authority, and separate from that and have congregational, really they thought of in terms of congregational autonomy. You have a covenant, people would covenant together to form a local work. And so you see that in this group.
The right track.
They were on the right track. There's aspects. And we'll see this in several of these groups. There's certain things were on the right track, and just some things are on the wrong track.
Right.
And I say the basic beginning because it would change. Each church not only was autonomous, but they selected the deacons and their elders. Of course, they selected what they called pastors, which is really their teacher. It's the same kind of common term used for pastor in a number of denominations today. Okay, so that's their basic beliefs, and we'll see as that we go through even tonight. You know, those things do change with time.
They include infant baptism as well.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, they included infants. This group did. Early, they did.
Yeah.
As time goes on into the late 19th, early 20th century, and we're going to talk about something. There's another lesson or two down the way. I can't remember, but the Unitarians. Unitarians were a big movement in this general time frame, but the Congregationalists basically resisted that impulse at first, But they did become more liberal in their theology. And in this case, one part of being liberal is moving away from Calvinism. They did not put a creed. I could argue that, well, the beliefs around Calvinism is a creed in its own right, but they did not make a requirement for their membership creeds. They just did not impose that on anybody. But what was starting to happen is these groups were starting to think more liberally, and so they would start to move away from the Bible as any kind of authority for them. They moved from looking at the Bible as the literal word of God to much more along the lines of it being symbolic and not literally the word of God. And that would impact on their doctrines. They started moving into areas of worship within their congregations, moving more back toward a liturgical kind of a worship, which of course is what they got away from when they got away from the Church of England. They started to get, and maybe this is where they started to make their mark really, they got involved in the social gospel, social activism. And in their day, it was the abolition of slavery was the big thing with them in this time frame, in the 19th century, middle of the 19th century. And the other one was women being able to vote, or at least their status, raising their status, I guess is a better way of saying that. The first minister, quote unquote, in America, female minister in America, was a Congregationalist, a lady by the name of Antoinette Brown. Eventually, what would become kind of commonly called by them and us and a lot of people, the social gospel, was sort of a joint activity, or at least parallel activity between Congregationalists in the time when they started to move on the scene and Baptist churches. In fact, just a couple particular leaders championed it. Okay, so that's the sort of leanings they started taking. And as time went on, getting into the early 1900s, you start to see these, and we're going to see these in several of these groups, you start to see mergers happening. And I've listed some in your notes. We'll try to keep all of these straight. I'll ask you a question here in a second about this, see if anybody's heard of these. They had formed, just the congregational churches, those that saw eye to eye, formed an alliance called the National Council of Congregational Churches in the early 20th century. That council ended up merging with this General Council of the Christian Church. And really, this particular, what we call it, I guess they call it a fellowship, the Christian Church, in this case, was a group that had very much the same kind of beliefs as the Congregationalists, but they just emphasized Christian in their name was really the deciding difference between them. And so that merger was pretty easy. And then they, after some time, they called themselves, after that, this General Council of Congregational Christian Churches. Okay, and after that point in time, they ended up proposing another merger. And that merger took a little more time to come about, and it was with the Evangelical and Reformed Church. And I'm curious, anybody here ever heard of an ENR church? One person.
The what church?
Evangelical and Reformed. Isn't that interesting? One person. I happen to have a guy live next door to me in Louisville that was from the ENR, or was a member of his family, member of the ENR church back in that day. And I mean, I guess I can rationalize that a little, or kind of understand that, because Louisville, where I grew up, is a German town. I mean, it's got a lot of Germans in it, put that another way. And that the ENR had its history in as a amalgamation or a joining or merger of a couple of groups that had German and I think it was Swiss background. And so you've got, in this day and age, you've got this Churches of the General Council ended up merging with the ENR Church. And the ENR Church was, as the name implies, a merging of Evangelical Synod of North America and the Reformed Church. So you've got, if you go back just a little bit in time, think about these groups. There's four different groups, ultimately end up merging into one. And yet, in many ways, what I read, the four groups, where there are differences, they continue a lot of times to practice those differences. It's not a common, it's not like being in the Catholic Church, is best way I know to describe it. This new group, where these four have ultimately come to one, is called the United Church of Christ. Anybody ever heard of the United Church of Christ? Oh, what have y'all heard about it? Do you remember anything? You just heard the name. Oh, it's different than Unitarian. Just a little bit of political trivia. Barack Obama is a member of the United Church of Christ. Is Fred, is that United or just Liberal Church of Christ? United?
Fred Johnson went to the His mother goes to the congregation I worship at in Tennessee.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I don't know that, you may be right. I have not read it anywhere, but I do know Barack, and in fact, if you're just interested in it, you don't have anything better to do your time, look up the Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago. And it's kind of an eye-opener of the sort of beliefs they have. And in this case, it's a black church. Essentially all black. And they have some very interesting beliefs as far as what they stress. No, just that one. Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago. But anyway, that's trivia for you.
Well, in 64, when they got married, it was United Church of Christ, Evangelical,
and Reform.
All of it is on the sign.
Yeah, and eventually.
Still together.
It is the organization that has survived all these mergers. Okay. Now that's not to say there aren't other congregationalist groups that have formed other groups. This is typically what happens. You get, it can be more between, 50-80% of a group that's affiliated together. These churches that are affiliated together in a group. And that group decides to merge with some other group and some of them won't agree. And so they stay out.
On 2920, as I go by there going to the golf course a lot of times, there's this little congregation on the corner, and I can't remember the name of it, but it says in parentheses down there, it kind of explained they're in the Reformed denomination. In other words, they're part of the Reformed denomination, so it says.
I think you still see this on Baptist church. You'll see on signs for Baptist churches. You'll see them affiliated. They'll have some subparagraph on the sign, affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention, or it'll be something else. Yeah, there's several different Baptist groups that are like that. And I think the thing that I would just kind of draw our attention back to, we'll continue to see this with other groups. It's the old thing, when you get away from the Bible and the authority of the Bible, there is no limit to where it goes. And so you find folks that have different beliefs. They're man-made beliefs in a lot of cases, in most cases, in terms of content. And they're kind of at liberty to do as they so choose. And there's a second thing I think you and I can look back on now that wouldn't be necessarily true in, the year 1905 or something. And that is that a lot of the mainline, what I call the mainline denominations, have over time had their doctrine diluted, even their doctrine diluted, just like these folks started out very Calvinistic and that got diluted with time, and it heads toward more the feel-good social religion, social gospel kind of thing. Just watch for that as we go through this. I think you see that, and particularly in the American, that's where we're going to spend our time, American denominations as we go on.
I had never seen a primitive Baptist congregation anywhere, and there was a little town mall going to my daughter's house. I stopped there and took a picture of the sign.
Primitive.
I'd never seen a primitive Baptist.
Primitive Baptist?
Yeah.
I'm going to go back and look. I used to know what they...
They're real strict on a lot of things.
Yeah.
The Baptist church stuff. The Southern Baptist, but they don't do a lot of stuff.
Right. Okay. And I added something. This is something that came up kind of as a afterthought. It just fits right in with this idea of this liberalism that was creeping into the congregational churches. And this goes back into the 1800s. We step back in time again. And you can read this on your own. I just wanted to highlight, this is just an example of the kind of liberal thinking that was going on within this group. Even to the point, the guy's a mystic, and truth is obtained by intuition. Okay, can you imagine that as the basis for truth? And he didn't accept, didn't teach that Jesus' death on the cross had any merit relative to the forgiveness of sins, no atonement value. It was strictly a moral influence. Horace Bushnell. Should show up in an addendum. Do I have it? Is that in your notes? It is, isn't it?
Yes.
And it just shows up at the last page of that lesson.
Is this intuition? Is it sort of like, the Lord spoke to me and the Lord told me this and the Lord told me that?
Well, he was a mystic kind of believer, and it may have been some of that. Some of it, I think, was just simply, you know what you ought to do, kind of a concept. And so whatever's right in the eyes of me, that's what I think I ought to do. And so he was preaching and teaching that way. He ended up being renounced by a lot of people. However, he still had a big influence, which is often the case. People like this that teach this way and are in positions of authority or power or influence will have an influence, and then they'll never take hold in the sense of a movement following after them, but they will take hold in terms of impacting on in this case on the theology of the people they are around. Didn't matter how bad or how good his conscience was. Okay. Anything? We're really still going to be talking a little bit about in effect about congregationalists here in a minute. I say congregationalists, that line of not congregationalists so much as people who separated out of the Church of England. I did not intend to cover the 39 articles of religion. I tried to cover that. We'd probably be here to the end of the quarter on these 39 articles. I just wanted you to have a chance to read them and see, scan them, whatever, and see the kind of creed that exists in this case for the Episcopal Church. But it applies to more denominations accept this than just the Episcopal Church. But it gives you an idea of what their foundation is. And we're going to hear some others, like the Westminster Confession as an example, the London Confession. These are all very much very similar to the 39 articles. Most of those that I'll mention them when we get to them. They are typically what they call chapters, 33, 34, 32 chapters, and they're really, these are called articles, those are called chapters, same thing. They're paragraphs defining what they believe. And depending on the group, if you want to be part of this group, you've got to believe that too. Okay? So I don't know if y'all have any questions out of that. I'd be glad to muddle around in it if you do. No, they not really. No. No, they would have followed these 30. I mean, to the extent they had a creed, and they really didn't put a creed on you, but to the extent they had a theology, many of the things in terms of the theology part of it would have followed the 39 Articles, because it comes out of those basically come out of the Church of England. And that's their origin. But when you get to things like the role of the king or the organizational aspects of it, of course Congregationalists aren't going to accept that. And so they didn't really use 39 Articles as their creed per se.
Well,
somebody. Hang on a second. Let me get to item 6.
Are these additional books, or are they just other names for books that exist? Or like an author in the Bible?
Oh, these are the same. They've got Ruth, 2nd book of Ezra, and 12 prophets. Well, that's really not fair either, because there isn't. Let me rephrase that. Things like, if you go through the line, I don't think there's anything on the first page. They've got they're going to name things different things. Third line, I don't know where it is on yours. Deuteronomy, First Book of Chronicles, Ecclesiastes, a preacher, we know those. Joshua, Second Book of Chronicles, Cantica, I'm not sure about it. I have to look that up. I don't know if that's another name like that they're applying like preacher or not, without going back and checking. They've got the maybe the Psalms. Yeah, because they don't have Psalms in here, I don't believe. Oh yeah, they do too. I don't know what that is. Oh, it's our Song of Solomon. Sorry, yes, right. Can't read my own writing.
But then you get First Book of Ezra. Okay. The
four prophets greater, I think, are the major prophets. That's what they mean by that. And the 12 are the minor prophets. And Ezra's are apocryphal books. And same when you start getting down all these down below, you know, they're saying don't establish doctrine with them, but they are things to read for examples of how to live your life. And these are a bunch of the apocrypha. Okay.
And then item 33, excommunication, did they practice that?
Yes. Sure did. Yeah, of course it was in their case it would be on a local basis, but yeah, they did. They maintained discipline of the group. Today I'm not sure, Lauren. With the, you know, as modern as they are today, for the mainline, I'd be surprised if they do.
So do they claim the code 39 Articles today?
No. Let me restate this. 39 Articles ties back fundamentally to the Genesis in the Church of England. I mean, it's consistent with that teaching. It's the Episcopals that hold these 39 Articles.
Modern
Episcopals? Yeah. They've modified them. U.S. people have modified them, I know.
So many of those that had ties to Church of England, Catholic, that was a big influence in their organization. Still, a lot of those they brought right on over with them.
Yeah, the one thing they didn't bring is the king.
Right.
So leave that guy home. But yeah, the ones I've listed here are really the Episcopal. You can go to a webpage for Episcopals, I'm sure you could find this very thing on that. And if I want to think about Congregationalists, I think about two things. One, doctrinally Calvinistic, and you don't have to go much beyond that. I can stand up here for another 4 hours. And then organizationally, it was congregational, local. Okay, ready to go to 14? Lesson 14, as we're prone to do, my wife was getting on me today because she said she couldn't keep up with all this, and I said, well, I kind of understand. Because it's not a fixed time, we're not going through a fixed timeline. And we're doing a lot of this, and I recognize that. But frankly, as I told her, I couldn't take 10 or 12 different denominations that are all happening and getting developed somehow at the same time and parallel all of them, and I couldn't keep them straight. Maybe you could, but I couldn't. So we'll go back and we'll pick up some of these things we've heard before and then show how they fit into, hopefully, the development of things we know. And then we're going to do that with the Anabaptists as we talk about the Baptists. Remember, in terms of the Anabaptists, well, let me make a statement. The lesson, primary aspect of the lesson we just had, dealt with coming out of the Church of England. So it's the development of a line coming out of England. Well, at the same time, over in Switzerland and over in, or just on the continent, let's say, but primarily Germany and Switzerland, following Luther and Zwingli, they had a big influence, and there's a couple developments that headed out from them in the Reformed Church and in the Lutheran Church. But there are a lot of other developments that had their genesis from a theology standpoint with those two guys, but they weren't in line step with them. And so you see a development going on on the continent of Europe that has to do with followers that might believe the basic teachings of these two guys or aspects, but they disagree with them in other areas, so other groups get started. The fundamental thing I want to talk about with, go back and review on Zwingli and Luther, is what was Luther's approach to Scripture? And how you activate it, or how you used it, or whatever. You said something. I just missed it.
I said it's not stated scriptures.
If it's not stated, it's not stated or not denied, either one, it's authorized. It can be practiced. And Zwingli's approach was, if you're going to practice it, you only practice it because the scriptures teach to practice it. And so it's two, you know, basic differences between those two. Well, the Anabaptist came on the scene as really an offshoot of his thinking, teaching. And we've talked about this. We had a very, I think it was one little paragraph to summarize it. They did not believe in infant baptism. They were not Calvinist in that sense. Nor did they accept the church state relationship that had existed because of the Catholic Church and the emperor, the empire that existed at the time. The Lord's Supper was a simple memorial. Strict church discipline was observed. They excommunicated. Many believed that a Christian could not be in government, could not be a magistrate in government. Likewise, they believed that you shouldn't take an oath or carry a sword, as far as their teachings went, and they used the scriptures as their sole authority and really stated that they were trying to get back to New Testament Christianity, first century Christianity. And as we talked in a previous lesson, they were, I guess we talked about a particular guy, they were persecuted, and many of them were drowned as they were being persecuted, not only by the Catholics, but by the Protestants of the time.
Did they believe that all things were common? Because I noticed in Article 38 of the Episcopal Synod, it mentioned Anabaptists per se.
In Article, it mentioned Anabaptists?
Yeah, it says the riches and goods of Christians are not common as touching the right title and possession of the same, as certain Anabaptists this big cross for Bubba's?
That's interesting. I don't recall running into that with them.
The riches and goods of Christians are not common as touching the right title and possession of the same, as certain Anabaptists do falsely boast. So, it implies that the Anabaptists thought that all the riches and goods of everybody were common.
I've got here this is Mennonite. It's not Mennonite and Anabaptist. Much the beliefs are very similar, but I don't see that in their doctrine. I don't remember ever running across that, frankly.
I thought it was interesting because in all these articles, I think that's the only place that they mention.
And there may have been some groups. Remember, one of the things I said, you may not remember it, but the Anabaptists, when they were starting to appear on the scene, they had a fundamental belief in the need of believers' baptism. But there were some, there's a wide variation once you got past that. Some of them were pretty extreme. Hang on a second. Let me just go back and
many that were baptized of infants were required to be baptized again as adults. That's one thing.
Oh, yeah. Hang on a second. See if I can find it. One group had imminent coming of Christ. They thought they knew when and where he would come. So they were predicting that. Some of this group practiced community ownership. And he went so far as to advocate polygamy. So I didn't. I've just forgotten it. So, was that you taking a breath? So, I mean, they were, they had groups. And I think that's probably what that's addressing, a group, or some groups.
That's a lot. I just read in the economics textbook a few weeks ago, the short section they had on socialism and communism. They said that the earliest recorded socialist society you read about was the next war.
That's interesting. Yeah. I suppose in a sense... Well, I wouldn't say that's the first one I ever read about in a sense, but I understand why they say that from their perspective. The Anabaptists were not true Baptists, and one reason I say that, and you see it in their beliefs, for one, but the other is they practice baptism by pouring as well. Now, in fact, the early Baptists were not immersers either, the real early ones, but these were pours, and in fact the beliefs of this vintage, when they first at this early stage, and we'll see that happen as this develops, would be in the modern day would probably be the Mennonites, would be more like today's Mennonites, would be more like what this group was like as far as what their beliefs are. That's the reason I've grabbed a Mennonite doctrine list. The Mennonites themselves were in the Netherlands. They grew up in the Netherlands. They held, in fact, this guy Menno Simon was a Catholic priest. This is who the Mennonites are named after eventually. He was a Catholic priest, and he had contacts with those of Anabaptist views, and it influenced him. And so he started to take on some of those same views and affiliated with that with an Anabaptist group. And as time went on, he ended up, the Anabaptists, as I said a moment ago, being persecuted. And he ended up with a group, and they changed their name from Anabaptist to Brethren. And they did that strictly to avoid the persecution, because the name had gotten such a bad rep at the time, bad reputation at the time. And then eventually they adopt this terminology, Mennonites, and that's what they're known as in the modern day. There was a, this kind of shows you the extremism of some Anabaptist groups. There was one group that went in, a place called Munster, and ended up, best analogy I have today, they became the Taliban of this town. it basically put their laws into place. They were very strict, and it ended up being a rebellion against them, and they were, much of them were killed. And so this fellow Mano Simon ended up, that whole aspect ended up causing him to want to take a group and protect them from the radicals, the people that would go in there and try to take over a town and set up this rule under Anabaptist theology and government. And so he saw himself being called to protect the movement from those kind of radicals.
Where was that?
Munster? It is in, Germany. These were Anabaptists did that.
They were heavily persecuted by Roman Catholics and Protestants.
Oh yeah, the Anabaptists were.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So the Anabaptists were heavily persecuted by Roman Catholics, and many attempted to find refuge in parts of Russia and Germany.
Yeah, the thing was happening here. This guy was trying to protect, so he says, was trying to protect the Anabaptist people from being taken over by these radical Anabaptists. That was his charge in life, he felt. And he, a lot of the same things as Anabaptist groups would have taught in the day, church membership on the basis of a personal conversion, believer's baptism, as an adult baptism, taught against holding civil offices, some of the same things I just mentioned a while ago, having to do with Anabaptists, got associated with the Mennonite Church. Of course, no state control of the church was one of the main things for this kind of a group. It ended up that a lot of the Dutch, this kind of Anabaptists ended up moving to the States, what would become the United States, and took up. It was a country where you could be a Mennonite and not worry about persecution, and that's what they ended up doing. So a lot of them moved over here back in those days.
1697.
Is that the date?
Yep. Yes, 1697. Jacob Hammond split from the Mennonite group because of his more conservative views on fellowship, thereby forming the Amish.
Okay, that's even different group, see. They're actually two distinct groups. Amish and the Mennonites are different. Same family, just different groups.
Yeah.
We're not going to talk about that, fortunately. The other thing that was happening is a lot of the English Protestants were, and we've talked about some of these people would go to Holland, be influenced by these Anabaptists and go back to England, and they'd carry that with them. And so you end up having Anabaptist groups show up in England. And now time is going on to the point that Anabaptist groups in England, what's Anabaptist mean? Baptized, one on top of the other, baptized again. But this second generation, and they're not being baptized as children. They're being baptized as for the first time. So they sort of dropped the Anna part of it, and it just became Baptist. So that's one type of Baptist, not like the American Baptist we'll study about in a moment, but that is a form of or groups that would call themselves Baptists. There were other groups that came out of his influence and congregations. One of them was, you may have heard these names. These were in Germany. One took the name of group took the name of or were called Dunkards, D-U-N-K-A-R-D-S, Dunkards, or Tunkards. I'm not sure. The Dunkards are real, and Tunkards are real. I'm just not sure what the genesis of the name is. And then they would eventually come to the States and practice, and their practice would be immersion here. So there's actually Quakers, Mennonites, I guess Amish in a sense come out of them too. The Dunkards, Baptists, they all have the origin in the Anabaptist movement. Okay? So that's the role these people played and started the doctrines that were developing at the time.
Do you know Mennonite? Is Menon a person? Or
yeah, Menon Simon. That's his name. Menon Simon. This guy we've been talking about. uh, I tell you what, I want to do, rather than, before we get into English Baptist, in 5 minutes we've got left, or less, I've been using these terms, and I thought it might be worthwhile to look at this. We won't go into it in detail. I just want to make a couple highlights on it. You may recall we talked about Jacob, Arminius, and the Arminian doctrine. And this, I thought this was a pretty good summary of when you talk about, and I will mention people that are Arminian. I keep, you know, we keep talking about these groups that are Arminian. And that's juxtaposed to Calvinism here. And just to run down and kind of flip back and forth, Arminianism was a belief in, or had as one of its tenets against, and we'll look at this against Calvinism, free will. Faith is the sinner's gift to God. It is man's contribution to salvation, whereas in Calvinism, faith is the God's gift to sinner, is the way they would state it. So it is, in the case of the Arminian theology, you have free will, human ability. This is the same. I mean, we have free will. We have human ability. We are responsible for our action. And we have the will to do that. They believed in conditional, not unconditional election. I say they believe. This doctrine teaches that. And so you... Of course, they have a view about God's sovereignty, being sovereign nonetheless, but they believe that people God foresaw who would respond to the call. That's the idea with them, whereas in the case of Calvin, it was certain individuals were predestined and they were going to be saved whether they liked it or not. Will had nothing to do with it, and election was unconditional. They believed in general atonement. We're going to see this with the Baptists we look at. There's general and there's particular atonement. And with Arminian, it is Christ died for all men, Christ saved none simply by his death. Rather, Christ provided the means by which you could be saved, but you had to take action. In the case of the Calvinists, Christ died for the elect. And they were saved from that death no matter what they did, because they were elected. Holy Spirit can be resisted, and as much as man has a free will, he can successfully resist the Spirit's call. And of course, in the case of Calvin, it was irresistible. There's an inward call that inevitably would lead you to be saved, and the last point, perseverance of the saints. Once you're chosen under Calvin's theology, you couldn't be lost, as we all know. And in the case of falling from grace in Arminians, what's happened, people would accept, we call them Arminian in their doctrine, but what that really boils down to in this particular area, and we're going to see this with the Baptists, in some cases, there's not agreed on this. Some cases, they believe in the preservation of the saints. Some cases, they don't. Just depends on what group you're looking at. So we'll see that. We'll kind of see the Baptists evolve, the American, what we know as the Baptists in this country. We'll see them evolve doctrinally from being Calvinists, particular Calvinists, to something much more along the lines of Arminian, interestingly enough. Okay, it is quarter after. So we're going to quit there, and we will pick up at English Baptist, number 2. What is it? What you need? One of these? Oh, yeah. Take one. Get one out of there. 9:23. Is that what? I guess that's what Sunday is.
Minnow Simon or Minnow Simon?
Minnow. M-E-N-O.